Welcome to the teleclass titled The Neuroscience of Change, Exploring the Shift. In this teleclass, I'm going to be interviewing our very own Dr. Dave Kruger. So let me tell you just a little bit about Dr. Dave, and then I'm going to introduce him to all of you. So Dr. Dave Kruger is an executive mentor coach and CEO of MentorPath, an executive coaching, training, publishing, and wellness firm. His approach integrates the insights of psychology, neuroscience, and the quantum physics with strategic coaching to help professionals and executives write the next chapter of their life or business stories. Dr. Dave is author of 16 trade and professional books on success, wellness, money, self-development, and 75 scientific papers. His coaching and writing focus on the art and science of success strategies, Mind Over Matters. McGraw-Hill recently released his latest book titled The Secret Language of Money. It is a business bestseller and has been translated into 10 languages. Dr. Dave is a mentor, coach, trainer, and dean of curriculum here at Coach Training Alliance. He's been quoted in Money, Fortune, Forbes, Town and Country, and the New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal, and was elected to the American Society of Journalists and Authors. He is the founder and director of his own licensed, specialty-certified New Life Story Coaches and New Money Story Mentor Training, and he has trained professionals worldwide. So welcome, Dr. Dave. It's great to have you today on the call.
Thanks, Lisa. It's great to be here.
Excellent. I am really looking forward to this topic. I know this is such a hot topic for all of us that are coaches. The title I love, The Neuroscience of Change, Exploring the Shift. So I wanted to just start by asking you, can you tell us a little bit about your emphasis on the mind and brain and how you see psychology, neuroscience, and quantum physics applying to coaching?
Well, my emphasis began way back with my favorite athletic coach. He was the most powerful mentor after my dad, and he kept saying, your mind is the most powerful thing in the world. Mm-hmm. And it worked for several championships and became just imprinted in a beacon when I decided to specialize in psychiatry and subspecialize in psychoanalysis. And all those experiences of the importance of mind, body, spirit have influenced coaching. And more recently, I've seen how much the advances in especially neuroscience, some in psychology research, and some in quantum physics in the last decade can be added to our work in coaching and integrated to help us help people change and understand the process of how mind, brain, and behavior all interact in change.
Mm. So the big question that all of us are wondering is, so why do we resist change? And even change that something, or even changing something that doesn't work for us, why do we resist it?
Well, part of the struggle to embrace change, whether that's individual or corporate, is that so many of the methods that we use to facilitate change are contrary, opposite to how the mind and brain work.
Mm.
So for people to actually undertake change, there are some specific steps that they need to take in order to affect those changes. Now, part of the answer to why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone. It's secure, mm-hmm. It's predictable. A comfort zone can be limiting or uncomfortable, but it's familiar. It's a default model. And we repeat because we know how it's going to turn out, and that creates at times the illusion of effectiveness. And also people don't change because at times they don't feel safe changing. Changing means leaving their home base of reality, their internal map that's synonymous with their identity. So we tend to return to our default mode. There's always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. And another part of that answer, I think, is in our brains. Whenever we do something repetitively, our brain makes it very efficient. This has been an evolutionary benefit that whenever we do something repeatedly, we make it the default mode. The brain creates new cells and new pathways to lay down to make it automatic where we can use energy for other things.
Mm.
Let me give you an example of that.
Yeah, that would be great.
Milton Erickson, the very famous hypnotist, told a story from his childhood in which whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so that he could create a fresh path in the snow. Now, he intentionally created a circuitous path with zigzags, indirect turns, and he noticed that every person who followed him followed the same path. Until the end of the day, the path was very well worn, despite its very circuitous route. No one started a new, more direct route. No matter how many twists and turns, he got increasingly complex and mischievous. Every person in turn followed the path of least resistance. This is how neural pathways are laid down in the brain, by early experiences, then repeated until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous. So for us to think creatively or just differently, new neural pathways need to be developed outside the cycle of experience. So as we think about coaching, then, Lisa, you know, one of the things that we think about is stimulation for new insight is a circumstance where the brain can't predict what's going to happen next. We ask powerful questions. We brainstorm. We challenge. We nudge. And the catalyst for insight is a novel stimulus, new information, or a new context. That's what we're experts at.
Right, right. Oh, that's such a great story, too. So why are bad choices so easy and good ones so hard?
Well, that's a good question. We naturally resist moving away from our comfort zone of familiarity, not just because we know the outcomes I mentioned, but because it's the default mode that's grooved in the mind and the brain. And then bad choices usually involve immediate reward, like cheesecake, drugs, risk, dopamine, appropriately named dopamine, mediates the excitement, even of anticipating a pleasure. Now, good choices, on the other hand, involve later payoff, broccoli, exercise, saving money. Now, the good news in terms of us as coaches, the good news is that with repeated new experiences, we can rewire our brains and revise mind software, new pathways to new communities in the brain. So the key success strategy to write the next chapter is a structured plan and to stick to it. Now, part of that is that you know or determine specifically what you don't want to do. You know, you may not always know exactly what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. So whatever we do, we need to do it consistently. And we develop maybe something like a continuity program to make a good decision automatic. One example is an automatic withdrawal from a bank account to fund or saving a retirement account. It's a good decision we only have to make once.
Excellent. What about how does change involve neuroscience instead of just doing things differently?
Well, the way our minds and brains work, a belief, for example, if we talk about beginning with a client, a belief or a fact that the client has is an anatomical reality in that client's brain. So we can't just present a new fact or an idea and expect it's going to overwrite what the client already knows or believes. So change is a process, and we have to understand and mentor that process. And this is why it's so important to understand about human dynamics and about how the mind and brain both work, because we have to begin with where the client is and move ahead in a stepwise way. One of the best supervisions I've had about this is I offered to a client a comment on what I thought was a perfect coachable moment. The client paused and just said, "No, Kruger, first you have to be with me before I can go someplace new with you."
Ooh.
It could not have been said more succinctly, because that's exactly what we have to do with a client. We have to be with them. We have to perhaps empathically resonate with their experience and build a common ground. Then together, we can take the next step forward one step at a time. So it has to be a process, and we have to really appreciate how much the client has their belief system and what they've done just as part of who they are. No, mm-hmm. neuroscience teaches us that about 95% of our operating system is not conscious, because so many of the patterns, the attachment patterns, and the beliefs and notions were laid down early in life, and they've become a part of that operating system. And then we use those beliefs and those assumptions without even being aware of it. So only 5% of our operating system is conscious. So that means that a whole lot of what we do is not conscious or logical or intellectual. So we really have to look at and examine how we make choices and how we think about it. So mm-hmm. what that means practically then is that we can write two stories simultaneously. The surface story, the one that's from the conscious operating system, will be like, I want to make more money. I want to generate wealth. Now, the shadow story that activates from a long time ago is, well, you know, people who really have money are luckier. I wasn't born to be wealthy. You know, so that shadow story counters that. So what we do in coaching is that we listen for two stories. If a client is creating two stories simultaneously, especially if they're in conflict, we want to help them be aware of both so that they can unify into one cohesive story that's also aligned with their needs and their ideals, so that all of them can go in the same direction.
Oh, I love that. Oh, that's great. That's great stuff. I'm taking notes. Well, let me ask you this. Do the ideals of men and women differ?
In a way, they do. Because if we look at what ideals really means, ideals are the internal values that we have. And when we have our own ideals that are attainable, then living up to them is the place, is the way that we generate self-esteem. And that's the only place I know that self-esteem comes from, is having our own internal attainable ideas and living up to them. Now, what's the opposite of having ideals and experiencing self-esteem? Failing to live up to ideals, or having ideals that are unattainable, results in the experience of shame. And that's the worst feeling somebody can have, because it's not about what you did, like guilt, that you can undo or rectify or remedy in some way, but shame is more about who you are. So this is where we have to listen in coaching, because the message of shame and shame-based dynamics are partly gender-related. Mm-hmm. For example, for women, this is the way it may show to counter some vague sense of shame of I'm not good enough. And remember, this could be even from early on when we looked into the mirror of parents and hopefully, ideally, saw a perfect reflection and an affirming reflection, so that we could then internalize that idealization of parent to become our own ideal and live up to it and feel I'm good enough, I'm enough, and this is great. Now, if that didn't happen, this fast forward to adulthood. For women, when they counter or try to counter some vague sense of shame, they want to be perfect,
mm-hmm.
prettier, thinner, quieter. Now, Lisa, for both you and my wife, thankfully, you were not around the day they sent that memo out.
I know it.
be more helpful, be more loving, be more giving to others, or the desire to spend and shop to counter an unconscious whisper of, you really need to look better. Now, for men, it's different. Men feel as if they need to be more stoic, stronger, unemotional, do more or make more, or even the desire to compete physically or by expensive acquisitions to counter this unconscious whisper of, I need to see evidence of worth. So it does manifest it. The dynamic is the same, but the way it shows itself can be different. So these are some of the things that we listen for, especially if we hear a client being driven or not ever feeling satisfied or having a sense of what good enough or just simply being enough is.
Yeah, that's a great explanation.
Sense?
Yes, absolutely. That really clears it up. So because we come to things automatically and without thinking about them, how can we be aware of errors and of mistakes?
Well, the brain has an error detection mechanism, and it's very close to the emotional centers of the brain, and you can never ignore your next-door neighbors. So when our brain creates patterns of connections as we search for meanings, our predictions get confirmed, and then patterns become hardwired and automatic. Then we notice something that doesn't fit the predicted pattern. So this error detection mechanism of the brain activates when something happens that we don't expect. You know, an example is you accidentally go to the refrigerator and take a swig of milk, and suddenly it's orange juice, and it's like, wham, you know, that your brain fires because you weren't paying attention. So the error detection mechanism of the brain explains some things, I think, that can't be explained just by doing things differently and departing from the superhighway of the familiar and trying something different, which is a common experience that we have with clients, that we have to help them understand that the model that they're using of an anxiety or uncertainty or trepidation as they try out something new doesn't feel good. It doesn't mean that their intuition is saying this is where not to go. It just means that they're trying something new, so it's not going to feel familiar and comfortable in the beginning. Comfortable is not a place you began. So explaining that and how their minds and brains work in that regard can be helpful. Now, back to the error detection mechanism. This is one reason that when we tell a client what to do or tell a client an answer or our answer, it immediately starts the error detection mechanism firing because their brain says, that ain't right. This is not the way it works. So here are some subtle ways that this error detection mechanism works. We notice differences more easily than familiar, the confirmation. So it's easier for us to focus on things that we do wrong. And we may struggle to list our strengths because those are just, you know, part of the system. If advice is unfamiliar or unwanted or just unasked for, it's going to set off that error detection response. So somebody is going to reject an idea before they even consider it, which is another barrier to resist change. So this is helpful to know. We focus on problems, and that energizes, actually, paradoxically, because it activates that error detection mechanism. Also, think about how this works. Bad news gets our attention for the same reason. A road accident causes people to stop and stare. It's the unexpected that commands attention. So that's why the evening news leads with, you know, the local meeting of the gun and knife club and all the, you know, the guys that have strayed from their marital vows, and those things lead the news. The same way mystery and thriller stories engage us to see things that don't make sense and connect. Otherwise, one or two mystery novels would have been enough, but we keep going. I keep going.
Yeah.
I'm hooked on, you know, thriller and CIA shows. And a universal approach to storytelling actually builds energy by conflict when things don't make sense, and then there's that release when things do finally make sense. So this is part of storytelling. This is sort of related. I won't even go into it, but I have my blog, my money blog, archived, and there's one of the blogs, When Lies and Debts Are Similar, because lies and debts both trigger this error detection mechanism. When you tell a lie, it's not whether somebody else is going to believe you or not. It's that you know yourself it's a lie. So your own error detection mechanism has nailed you before anybody else gets through hearing the sentence. Debt's the same way. You spend money that you don't make. Hey, you know that's not right. I mean, you know that something's off. In other words, you're spending money, but you don't have it. What's going on?
Oh, this is all very interesting. And we've talked about before, and you've said to me, when we make important decisions, you should strike while the iron is cold. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Oh, let me finish up one thing that
sure.
I wanted to end on a positive note about this error detection mechanism. Part of the benefit in coaching is that we can use this brain's error detection mechanism as part of a powerful internal navigation system for the client. And that's simply about teaching the client how to do this, how to read it, how to use it, because they can use that, which would otherwise be confusing or discombobulating, as a powerful internal navigation system. And that's not all that hard to do in coaching and can be very, very valuable as someone proceeds. Your question...
Let me just ask the question again, just so we can...
Yeah,
and we've talked about this before. When you make an important decision, you've talked about striking while the iron is cold. What do you mean by that?
Well, my belief is that there are a few true emergencies in life. You know, investing in stock, deciding on a summer vacation special that's good until 5 p.m., or as I did once, had to purchase mulch from the guy who's only going to be in the neighborhood setting, selling it until noon. Well, you know, my 11:15 a.m. decision resulted in a mushroom farm within about 2 weeks. So basically there's a few true emergencies. And in an excited state of mind, we think differently. We shift to a different state of mind and make decisions in a different way. A hot stock tip, a business deal gone sour, family tragedy can create an alarm response and an emotional state of mind that's really geared for survival rather than logic. And things that are emotion-based judgments will prompt adrenaline and cortisol, which can even hijack the logical, rational brain and cause us to think about more recent things, to overweight the emotional, and to lose the big picture. And the emotional brain can even hijack and hold hostage the left brain so that reasoning and logic and intellect are temporarily inaccessible. So basically each thought and feeling has a chemical consequence. And as I mentioned, the chemicals of emotion can alter mind and body. Now, how we determine what state of mind we use is personal experience, because we then determine what state of mind we're going to use, and that determines how we process, what information we take in, how we process it, how we proceed. So that's, you know, my belief is that the most powerful success tool or success strategy that we have in coaching, and especially I see this again and again with executives, is helping someone regulate states of mind and manage emotions. And knowing how to do that and helping a client do that, I think, can be very, very powerful.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I've tested this more than a few times, and striking while the iron is cold definitely works better for me.
So, personal experience. So how do we do that practically in coaching? Well, I'll think about it and get back to you is a decision.
Mm-hmm.
I'll sleep on it is a choice, because when we sleep on something, you know, we go through several states and wake up in a fresh state and reconsider it.
Right.
And think about how that might work in spending money. When you're in a flow of spending money, when you're shopping, either making money or spending money triggers dopamine, and that's the same pleasure chemical that just a little hit of cocaine will trigger and mimic. So there's the pleasure of spending. Now, what happens when we do it with a credit card? Two things. One, 23% more money is spent with a credit card because it's made it abstract. You don't have the pain of the payment. You're not seeing anything go. You just sign. And what also happens, payment triggers a part of the brain that's the disgust center, the same center that triggers when we have disgust, like at a rotten apple or seeing something that's distasteful on television. And this center of the brain is activated when we make payment. So what does a credit card do? It separates the pleasure of the purchase from the pain of repayment. So repayment is an abstract future event. So it's separated, so it's way easier to pay, it's way easier to buy something on credit than it is, you know, to have actual real money leave and have the also a blog that I have called 14 Ways to Outsmart Your Brain to Spend Less.
That's great. That's great. I've read it. It is. It's great.
Okay.
And you've talked a lot about mindset and states of mind. What's the role that that plays?
Well, a state of mind is a mind-body state, and it's like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and process information and how we respond. It's as specific as a particular software and as distinct as a particular software program is on our computer, like the difference between WordPerfect and Quicken. Mm-hmm. And we each have different states of mind, from very focused pinpoint attention when we're about to give a talk to a more relaxed, more kind of global floaty feeling when we're about to go to sleep. Or, you know, think about the different state of mind, for example, of creative writing, where you need to be in that free flow of creative mindfulness, and the more focused editing state of mind. Two different states of mind, two different functions, something that should be done at different times. So, also, in this regard, in terms of your question, our brains operate like a Google map. There's been some fairly recent research that shows how we create multiple independent maps while we kind of find our way along the world or consider a course of action. When a new situation arises, a new map's booted up. Now, this explains how we can have different context or frames for different situations. So what this actually means is that we have different states of mind or mindsets. Now, let me give you a kind of general example here. These mindsets are stored in our hippocampus, which is where we have our memory and creative focal point in the midbrain. And a mindset is really its own software program. It's complete. It's internally consistent. Let me give you an example of two very different kind of mindsets, and these are ones that I believe are important in coaching, to give you an example of how we can use that. A growth mindset or a fixed mindset. For a growth mindset, success is about learning. It's about proving you're smart. And the growth mindset is learning based on the belief that the basic qualities we cultivate, we develop, we evolve through life. We have an openness to acquire, to learn, believe that people can change and grow through experience. Now, if someone has a fixed mindset, and the first evidence of this, I would call it a coachable moment. Mm-hmm. It's a goal to prove oneself, in the classroom or in a career or in a relationship. Every situation compels a confirmation of intelligence or personality. And with a fixed mindset, no matter how much there's confirmation, this belief maybe in being mediocre or the belief in still needing to prove oneself is there. So with a fixed mindset, it's like if you have to work at it, it wasn't meant to be, so somebody can stop prematurely, or that problems indicate character flaws. So this is important, so important, I believe, in coaching, because learning about a growth mindset can cause a significant shift in the way people think about themselves and their life or wellness or money stories.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's very powerful. I like that. So there's been a lot of excitement about The Secret and using law of attraction coaching. Is there any scientific basis?
Good question, and absolutely. Actually, the law of attraction is based in neuroscience, though in the film and the book, they don't really emphasize it as much.
Mm-hmm.
Our minds are energy fields, and they respond to focus. In other words, where you focus your attention creates brain connections. Quantum physics tells us that each of us generate energy frequencies or vibrations, and we project energy in our emotions and thoughts that really become the source then of what and whom we attract, as well as our own sense of well-being. Let me give you a practical example of that. If you lay a nail and some iron filings side by side on the table, nothing happens. Now, if you take the nail and stroke it with a magnet several times, point, the nail becomes magnet and it can pick up the iron filings. The molecules of the nail become aligned. They become polarized, magnetized in the same direction. If you looked at it under an electron microscope, you'd see they all are aligned in the same direction. That creates a magnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
Same principle in your brain with your energy field. When all of you is going the same direction and focused, you have power. Now, the secret here, rather than being about wishing for something and getting it, is really about understanding and refocusing personal energy. Because
mm-hmm.
we get what we focus on, not what we want. So this mental act of focusing attention activates brain circuitry. And paying attention to this over time keeps these circuits open and active and eventually creates their own pathways and creates a change of structure in the brain. And the chemical links become stable as part of the brain's structure. So this is why, for example, in coaching, a solution focus is way more effective than a problem focus.
Mm-hmm.
Focusing on possibilities activates parts of the brain, creates new neural networks and pathways. Focusing on problems deepens or further etches the already existing circuitry. And this is why somebody can get stuck in therapy, because they review and revise the old story, work through the old story, but even the process of focusing on the old story etches these pathways further, and resolving the old story doesn't suddenly create a new story. So
right.
that's a part of what that's a part of what we think about. So the power is in the focus, and actually Einstein talked about this when he talked about the unified field theory. He said that we are a quantum of energy, and we interact with the energy field of another, or with the collective energy field of others. When we're in a group. So this is about alignment. This is about appreciating the intersubjectivity, the interaction of these energy fields. So what this means is that, you know, when they talk in The Secret about ask, believe, and receive, it's not going to work if you pick your lotto numbers and ask and believe and then expect to see. I can personally guarantee you that and
it hasn't worked for
the listeners some good deal of money. Think if you want to attract a pizza but focus on a pizza, it's not going to suddenly manifest. Now, there's a scientist called coincidence. Sometimes people who have a strong belief in, you know, anyhow. So what this does, and the secret behind The Secret, is also ancient wisdom. And it was captured
mm-hmm.
best by my grandmother, who said, wish it don't wash dishes. So if we change that to ask, believe, and create, that puts us responsible. It makes it our story, so that we can know these principles and know that we need to act and to create the story that we want. So it gives us the energy to sustain our focus and create an action plan to do what we want. So that the pen is in our hand to write our stories. And we need to do it strategically, specifically, systematically, and consistently. And that's exactly our expertise as coaches, to help people do it in exactly that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love the way you explained that. That's great. And you talked a bit about powerful questions, and in coaching we talk about asking powerful questions. What would you consider the most powerful questions you can ask? I know that could be a long, long answer, but...
Well, there are two questions that I think
mm-hmm.
can change your life. Dan Pink, the guy who wrote a couple of books called Thrive and Mind, forgotten the name of it. We were discussing our recent books and the application for professional coaches. And he told the story of Clara Booth Luce, one of the first women to serve in the U.S. Congress. She conferred with President Kennedy in 62.
Mm-hmm.
And she was concerned that his attention was divided among so many different priorities that he would be less than effective with his attention so scattered. And her conclusion to him was, a great person is one sentence. Abraham Lincoln's sentence was that he preserved the Union and freed the slaves. Franklin Roosevelt's sentence was that he lifted us out of a Great Depression and helped us win a world war. Now, a sentence can be, she raised two children who became happy and productive adults, or he helped many people grow to become who they really are. So, and I would say, here are the two questions. As you reflect on your purpose, or reflect with a client, what's your sentence?
Mm-hmm.
And then, secondly, as you go to bed each night, ask a small question. Am I better now than I was yesterday? So these are the two sentences that can be very powerful.
Oh, those are brilliant. I was yesterday. I'm just writing it down. Excellent. And are there times that we need to not change?
Yes. Actually, William James, the father of American psychology, wrote over a century ago that the greatest discovery of his generation was that people could change their lives by changing their attitudes of mind.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we assume in doing that that change is necessary and beneficial. Maybe its absence infers resistance or stuckness. And sometimes we kind of collude without even thinking about it to idealize change. But, as we talked about striking while the iron's cold, not changing at times, especially, for example, at times of pressure, impulse, or various seductions, can be a valid, informed decision. C.S. Lewis, I'm going to paraphrase this because I can't get it exact, but C.S.
Mm-hmm.
Lewis talked about an aspect of this. He said, we all want progress, but progress means getting closer to the place you want to be. But if you've taken a wrong turn, then going forward doesn't get you any closer. If you're on the wrong road, progress means doing a U-turn and walking back to the right road. And in that case, the man who turns back soonest is the most progressive man. Now, notice he said man because guys are the ones who never ask for directions.
I love that. I really love that. I've heard that before. Excellent. So why are money stories so elusive?
Well, you know, this is what I've written about in The Secret Language of Money and
extended
that in the new licensed, specially certified training I'm about to do called New Money Story Mentors to help people understand their money stories and their relationship with money. It's difficult. Actually, when I was talking with an internationally known self-help guru about this very question, he said, you know, Dave, I don't know how to tell my money story to myself in order to know what to change. And because so many of our money stories tell us less about money and more about our human mind and its operations. Money is like a Rorschach. You know, we project onto it whatever we want it to mean, and it can mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as we began to make money mean more than a simple, tangible thing, we stop understanding it. The more we give money meaning, the more we lose what it really means. And then, as you know, people do really goofy things with money. Intelligent people spend money they don't have. Sophisticated people get scammed. I'm working currently with two Madoff victims, both very well-known people, very successful people, very brilliant people, and both happen to put all of their savings in with Madoff and are, you know, on the road to recovery now. Rational people trade in leisure time to try to back, or for money to try to buy back some more of what they just forfeited. And think about how many times we hear this in training. Well, you know, I really want to coach artists, but they don't have any money. Now, why do we assume things like that? The surface story is, here's a person of exceptional talent, and the shadow story is, they don't believe that they can convert that talent into sufficient income. You know, that's an assumption that's coachable.
Right.
sometimes otherwise balanced people spend extravagantly, hoard compulsively. Reliable people ignore financial matters until they snowball. And I'm here in Houston. People with integrity write their own exceptions to rules about money. We're home of Enron, home of Stanford. So, but the good news is that we can learn about our money stories and change all of that. It does take the same kind of work in coaching that it takes with other stories, whether that's a life story, a wellness story, a career or a relationship story. There are ways that we can systematically help someone recognize, own, assess, and go through the process of change. And that's exactly what we do as experts at change and as choice architects, as coaches.
Right. And, you know, people talk about, you know, positive thinking. Is positive thinking enough to change?
No.
Yes.
It doesn't reprogram beliefs. Remember I mentioned that, you know, a fact or a belief is an anatomical reality in someone's brain. Positive thoughts are generated in the conscious mind. That's only about 5% of our operating system. Using positive self-talk in order to change behavior will have about the same impact as talking positively to a software program on your computer to get it to change. Instead, you have to know how to revise the software. You have to know what to do with the old program as well as how to write a new one. And you may need a guide. Yeah, the principle from New Life Story Coaching that I'll just, you know, say one sentence here. In adulthood, everything you experience, you either create or accept.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we coach around all the time.
Excellent. So what are some examples of using mind science in coaching?
Well, both our minds and brains contribute to new learning and to its paradoxes. For example, we seek closure and infer causality, whether it's accurate or not.
Mm-hmm.
Then, once we create a closure around that cause and effect, we then defend our position or decision, and instead of continuing to examine it. So we have a diagnosis or come to a conclusion and then have a bias, because what we do then is to look more so at things that will confirm it, cherry-pick data that's going to confirm it, and become blind to things that refute it. So our brains contribute here because they want to end dissonance and prematurely shut down inquiry. So we have to keep this alive and open. We have to monitor our choices, question our ideas,
mm-hmm.
recognize that emotional couplings can derail logic. You know, like saying money equals freedom or evil or greed. We have to probe our reasoning and always, always ask what works and what doesn't work.
Right. And what's
now,
an example?
You know, one thing we had. One thing that's helpful in this is to look at things in novel ways. You know, for example, everybody thought Goliath was too big to hit. David thought
mm-hmm.
he was too big to miss.
Right, right. Yeah, it's all a matter of how you look at it. And what's an example of what neuroscience teaches us about mentoring and about change?
That, as I mentioned, that we each have beliefs, information, facts in our brains as part of the structure of our brains. If that prior knowledge is physical, mm-hmm. real, and persistent in our brains, so we can't ignore them. They can't be simply removed or easily overwritten by another fact. They do atrophy with disuse, as other
mm-hmm.
ways of doing things take place. So if we ignore reality, and this is the reality I'm speaking of, it'll get in the way of new information and change. So as we mentor and co-create change, we have to start with where the client is. Remember my client said, no, Kruger, first you got to begin with me. Not where we are. We can't provide the tools for solving problems before the client knows and agrees on what the problems are. So this is why fixing doesn't work. This is why getting answers doesn't work.
You can't just
list the four reasons that an idea is wrong and expect it's going to rearrange somebody's neural network. And people are not always aware of their prior knowledge, partly because it's complex and personal, and partly because it's so subjective and not altogether conscious. So a mentor needs to begin with discovering prior knowledge and actually to begin with the concrete. This is why stories are so helpful. Specific examples help someone become ready for concepts and abstractions and principles. So mm-hmm. we have to begin where they are, begin simple, and really have in mind a system to deconstruct things to look at exactly what's going on. Let me give you just an example of that. Somebody comes to a conclusion that, you know, I'm not quite with them on what they're thinking. It's a belief or a conclusion. So I'll ask, help me understand how you thought about that to come to that conclusion. Or another example would be somebody said, well, you know, I had a plan and I had exactly what I was going to do, but then, you know, I just didn't do it. I put it off. I just didn't get to it. So I want to know specifically what that person's internal conversation was, the frame before they decided they wouldn't do something. They've already decided to do it, and the instant before they decided not to do it, to say no to themselves, I want to know that conversation. For example, is the conversation a bargaining with themselves to say, well, you know, I'll get to it next Tuesday? Or do they defy their own authority and say, oh, the hell with it, I'm going to do whatever I want to do? Or any number of other sort of convolutions of not doing it. I want to know exactly so that they'll know exactly and that they can address then that story, that instantaneous story of that moment they're telling themselves so they can change that conversation to be something that's consistent with their goals, their ideals, their needs, and their strategy.
So understanding that.
Exactly. And them understanding it, that way when they recognize and own that conversation, then they have the access to the possibility of changing it and changing it in the way that they want to. Because often this is a process that they're not even aware of, and they just come away with, you know, doing negative talk and say, oh, I messed up again. I don't know if I'm cut out for this. Or, you know, some kind of negative to conclude with a negative attribution rather than deconstructing exactly what happened so they can reconstruct it in precisely the way they want and need to.
Excellent.
To make it ultimately simple.
And that's the example of what neuroscience teaches us. What is the example of what quantum physics teaches us about mentoring and change?
Well, as I mentioned about how we generate energy frequencies and how we get what we focus on. So this tells us how we need to focus on what's positive and what we want rather than on what we don't want. Even specifically, how we focus can determine how we align energy. If you focus on, well, you know, I want to lose weight, or I want to get out of debt, those are focuses that are negative. And the way our unconscious works is the unconscious doesn't determine positive or negative, just the focus. It kind of works like the old-fashioned film on a camera where you can see the image or you can see the where you can see the print or the negative. It's the same image. So the unconscious will say, I'll bring about whatever you want. You focus on the negative, the unconscious says, I'll bring it about. You focus on the positive, you're aligning yourself with what you want. So it helps to really be aware of that, and some of the strategies that we can do, and just really simple strategies, is the first thing in the morning to think about a positive focus about what we align ourselves to do that day can set in motion this whole process. And the last thought before we go to sleep at night, it sets in motion the whole process of what your unconscious works on while you're sleeping. So that, I think, is something, and there's some practical aspects of that that won't even go into, but you know, for example, how somebody's energy field tells you immediately whether they're warm and inviting, cold or stay away, charismatic, energetic.
Right.
It helps us know about someone. We're always teaching people how to respond to us, and someone else is always teaching us exactly what it's like to be them. And I emphasize this to my coaches as well as my executives and professionals. Whenever somebody shows you exactly what it's like to be them, don't take it personally, but really use that as information, because that can be powerful information in the process of the work. Because they're showing you in vivo what the issues are. Whatever they're focused on, it's that interaction, that attachment pattern, that interactional behavior that is the process that shows you exactly what it's like to be them, that can be powerfully useful, and only the coach can get away with talking about that and making it useful, bringing it into focus, and looking at other ways to do that that can be more effective. Nobody can get away. You know, a spouse, anybody else on the board, any person in the executive suite, nobody can get away with talking about it. But the coach can, because it's exactly what you're paid to do, to talk about it. In a way that's empathic and caring and oriented to the person's success, but to really bring it into focus in a way that it can be useful in a collaborative way to co-create a new story.
Oh, that's awesome. That's very powerful. And I know you use visualization with your clients. What's an example of how you might use visualization with your clients?
Well, visualization really creates a new neuronal network in the brain. So you're creating a story that you're going to find a way to back into, and it creates a permanent change in the brain, especially when you do it consistently. So then the visualization rewires the brain. The affirmations revise the software. They're the story that support the visualization. So an example is the visualization of a healthy body. So as you visualize it, be sure it's your body, not somebody else's. I mean, you can't get Alicia Keys' body. It has to be your body. Now, with it being your body, have the right picture of yourself in your head in the current time. Ideally, you want to be in current. It can't be your body 25 years ago. No fair. You don't do time travel. write down your ideal body weight range. Write down your plan for exercise, weight, and nutrition. Write down your affirmations. Revisit it first thing in the day, end of the day. Make it positive. Again, use what we know about energy fields and positive focus. Don't make it about losing weight or diet, but make it where you want to be. 95% of people who lose weight gain it back.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? Most probably, they didn't revise their software. They revised their behavior for a time, but they didn't revise their software. And the software is the true body self, the true body image they have, that they create a vision and live into it. When they do that, there's not the reversion back.
Mm-hmm. I like that. Live into it. I love that.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote one of the books in psychoanalysis about success, a book that became one of the Master's 100 books of the most influential professional books of the 20th century, called Success and the Fear of Success in Women. But I really changed my mind, and that was in the mid-80s. Now I think in coaching, we as coaches have a way more powerful system to do that by creating a visualization, the full experience of success, all the sensory and all other elements, along with the affirmations, the story to support that, then, because we're creating changes in the brain. And when somebody creates that visualization, they've already created the experience of success, so they've obviated the fear of success because they've already created it. It's just a matter of strategy.
Yeah, they've already done it.
Yeah. Strategizing to back into it and figure out ways to actualize it.
Oh, excellent. That's brilliant. Love that. Okay. Well, you've written about mindfulness, and how does that fit in with what we're talking about?
It's what we help clients do. Mindfulness is an awareness of what's happening while it's happening. Mindful attention, which is really a full awareness of self, is an inherent capacity that we have. What it means is that we develop Mindfulness begins around, the capacity begins around age 5 or 6, when, mm-hmm. when kids at that age develop the capacity to recognize that the way they think about things is different than the way anybody else thinks about things. Before that, they think, well, everybody kind of thinks the same way. But they get they have the ability, if there's accurate and attuned empathic resonance with parents to help them be aware of their uniqueness and distinctness, that they have a mind of their own, they have a self that's distinct, and they have a whole way of thinking about how they think about things. And this is some of what we develop and enhance with clients, that someone can be mindful about things, they can think about being empathic with themselves and understand their own dynamics and understand the dynamics of others in a better way, which will make them much more powerful and much more effective.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that you've talked about and written about is mentalization and its role in coaching. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's just there's been a great deal of research and work in the last 4 or 5 years, especially in psychoanalysis from some of the direct infant observation and two or three key players. And I've kept up with it because I think it's such a powerful application for coaching. And it's kind of just a fancy way to talk about an awareness of mental states in oneself as well as others. And it involves an awareness of those mental states as representations of that person's reality. So we can see things from multiple perspectives. So one aim of coaching is to enhance this mentalization process, the engagement with clients to enhance their awareness of mental states in themselves as well as others can inform an understanding of their dynamics as well as help them regulate states of mind. And even most entrenched thought and behavior patterns can be changed by reprogramming the mind and rewiring the brain. And the mentalization is just a way of describing the process of becoming aware about that, thinking about what you're thinking, and the awareness of where you focus attention can be really useful in that regard. And let me give you just an example of this.
That would be great.
People who think of their future selves as me, who can really see themselves in the future, consistently choose to postpone things that will be beneficial so that they can do or be more better. They involve themselves in wellness programs. They save money for the future. In fact, Emily Pronin, a colleague of mine at Princeton, did a study just recently that showed that people who actually envision their future selves save 2 to 3 times more for retirement.
Really?
Which is very, very interesting. Now,
very interesting.
Just in the last weeks, a study on the West Coast did a computer enhanced version of this where it showed people how they're going to look in 30 or 40 years or however long. In other words, it kind of tweaks, helps along their own visualization of themselves in the future. And the early findings are that this significantly enhances their saving for the future. So think about what this means by being able to envision yourself or help your client do that in the future. You know, Warren Buffett said, you know, imagine what it's like if you have one car. And you know from the very beginning, when you get your first car, that's the only car you're going to have for the rest of your life. You're going to take better care of it. You're going to do better maintenance. Well, guess what? You have one body for the rest of your life.
Right.
When you envision that body into the future, are you going to work out, as Henry Lodge Jr. tells us, 6 days a week, regularly, with the same mindset as just going to work? You don't bargain with yourself. You don't feel virtuous if you do. You just go to work, and you just work out. So, are we going to do that? Are we going to save for the future? If we envision our future selves, absolutely, I think. I'm scared when I don't work out every day.
I know. That's excellent. This is very powerful. And thank you so much for joining me. I love interviewing you.
Thank you.
We have so such a good time. Yeah, and I mean, the topic I think is fantastic for our graduates and for all of us that are coaches, you know, the neuroscience of change and exploring this shift. This has been amazing. And I'm sure by now, as all of us are wrapping up here with our several pages of notes, that we're going to have questions, comments, things like that. So I'd like everyone to just kind of keep an eye out for an email, because what we're going to do is we're going to have some discussion and ability for you to post your questions and comments in Coaches and Mentors for all of us, and specifically questions for Dr. Dave, and we can get some answers out and we can connect around these topics, because this is just fantastic. I mean, I've got like three pages of notes here. So thank you, Dr. Dave, for sharing all of your wisdom and expertise. It's not only been really informative, but certainly a lot of fun as usual.
My privilege.
So thank you
so
much.
Thank you.
All righty. Thank you, Dr. Dave. Have a great day.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right. Bye-bye.